A million years of our prehistory, spent wired into the world and meshed within its elaborate ecological communities. And then, suddenly, in a mere sliver of time, a world of fences and constructs and artifacts to keep out weather, weeds, and wolves. But what if the full development of a humanness depends on contact with a non-human world? What if animals inform our cries and gestures, birds give wings to thought, lightning offers fire, beavers building techniques, the wind and rain and stars, their worlds of meaning and image and myth? How can we mature organically if we grow up in a mechanical and abstract world, so large of our own making, so much of it devoid of the plant and animal and mineral presences that nourish our ancestors so intimately? So I really like that. I really, really like that because it takes us out of this anthropocentric bubble we've kind of built around ourselves in, you know, Western civilization. And it links us to the larger world, which is what I find very refreshing.
Thanks.
Yeah. And I wonder if maybe you'd like to talk about, maybe to start off, your recent book, Terra Psychology, and explain. I think it's a pretty, not necessarily new, but a pretty seldom talked about concept for a lot of people.
Yeah. And it's actually a little premature in the sense that the book won't be published probably till the end of the year or so.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. I'm hoping the senior editor won't beat me up too much. But it comes out of my doctoral work, which was psychology with an ecological emphasis. And the basic idea of Terra Psychology as a perspective is that the world, as indigenous people have been telling us actually for quite a long time now, the world exhibits qualities of aliveness that show up in right in the middle of our own conflicts, folklore, even dreams, if we pay attention and understand how to interpret these different manifestations. So the book makes the assumption that we live in an animated living world and that there are ways to tune into it. What I've done is I've taken this indigenous thought and kind of applied what I knew of psychology to it in order to come up with a way to hear these terrestrial voices better.
Hmm. So basically you've been, I guess, using like your land base as a client in your psychological practice, in a sense.
Yeah, exactly. That was actually the question that I started out with. I thought, what would happen? I live in California and was born here. And I thought, what would happen if I started, for instance, reading the history of the different, the oldest cities that were colonized out here as case histories, somewhat the way therapists read the histories of their clients, you know, looking for symptoms and themes and recurrent conflicts and meanings. What would that give me a sense of if I did that? And as I read and looked around and noticed and kept track of my own dreams while I was doing this work, I began to get a sense of almost what one would call a personality at work, which after a time began showing up in my own dreams, which was very astonishing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things that actually triggered all the work, a series of dreams in which places would appear and say things about themselves. And my frustration at trying to understand these dreams with the usual psychological techniques that I had learned from 9 years of doing therapy and being trained as a therapist and that whole course of education.
Mm-hmm. It comes down to listening, eh? Like, I find it, I'm encouraged to know that you listen to your dreams. A lot of people just write them off as, nonsense and whatnot. And just how that relates to your listening of, like, the what might be, like, the spirit of place as well, where you live.
Yeah, it's it has to do with one of the things that the field called depth psychology, D-E-P-T-H,
mm-hmm.
has been interested in. And that depth psychology comes out of the work not only of Freud and Jung, but figures like James Hillman, Joseph Campbell. And what people trained in this tradition have started doing is giving the dream symbol a chance to speak for itself instead of overlaying it with interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applied this technique to dreams that felt very ecological to me. And an example of that would be one of the cities I looked at out here in California is San Luis Obispo. I hadn't been there. I had driven through it a couple of times. but I had never actually gone there and looked around and got the feel of the place and studied its history.
Mm-hmm.
And so the night before I did that, you know, I was preparing a road trip up there. I dreamed a very brief dream of sort of a visual picture of the place as seen from the freeway.
Mm-hmm.
And a word was kind of recurring in the dream, and the word was contamination. And I thought, huh, you know. So there's a lot of different ways to interpret that. A traditionally trained therapist might say that, you know, what in your psyche is contaminated? Do you have, what are your issues around contamination? From a research point of view, you know, what biases do you have that are contaminating your view of this place? I mean, there's all kinds of directions you can go in, but they're all exclusively human. You know, they take something ecological, or that at least feels ecological and felt that way in the dream, and they reduce it to very human formulations instead of, as depth psychology is learning to do, allowing the image to speak for itself. So my way of doing that was to say, you know, as strange as it may sound, maybe somehow the place and I are in some kind of interactive field, sort of the way a client and therapist are in session, and maybe the place is trying to tell me that it's got an issue around contamination. Who knows how, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and then once, of course, I went there, I mean, if any of your listeners have ever lived in San Luis Obispo, they know very well what I'm talking about. I just have to say things like, we'll talk about the beaches and the oil underneath them and things like that. Contamination's an enormous issue in San Luis Obispo, all the way from oil spills and underground contaminants to invasive species in Morro Bay. It's just all over the place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my way of at least trying to let the image have its own voice, you see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like that. And so how long have you been studying? Like, how long have you been into depth psychology and this whole realm?
Well, I've done it for, I've studied it on and off for almost 20 years. I was in therapy for a while with somebody who was trained in psychoanalysis, which was the science that came out of Freud's work. And, you know, of course, has vastly evolved in the last 100 years. And then I kind of read Carl Jung's work, hung out at Jung seminars. So I interested myself in that for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I actually ended up reading the collected works of Freud and Jung because it gripped me, and then went to a PhD program that specializes in Carl Jung's and James Hillman's work. So that was my path through depth psychology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting stuff. I'd like to talk a bit about like what you've learned in your research about like how like the connection between like what we normally consider inner issues and what happens to like the environment around us.
Yeah.
Like you ask, like how does local ecological destruction work its way into our psychological issues? And last week I spoke with Michael Cohen, who is linking a lot as well. You know, like the ecological destruction that pervades our society with our own mental illnesses and social ills and whatnot. And I was wondering, like in some of your perspectives you might offer through your research and all that, how have you found in your work that like those connections between our inner and outer issues and like the how the distinctions are really kind of irrelevant?
I went into the work about 5 years ago, you know, trained, as I mentioned, as in psychotherapy and in various schools of it, you know, family systems and other things. And I had heard lots of cliches that what we do to the world, we do to ourselves. And I really didn't take them very seriously. My background originally was not in eco fields like eco-psychology or environmentalism. So I would hear these things and they sounded very nice, you know, a little bit new agey maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really give them much credence until some of this work began. And what triggered it for me was a dream in which it was similar to the San Luis Obispo dream. Things that were happening ecologically in San Diego with the bay being polluted began showing up in my dreams. And I realized that some of these things were actually leaking down into relationships and folklore, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's originally what got me interested in it. But very much to my surprise and very much against my will. One of the big shocks I had along the way was I was, like I said, I was born in San Diego and I've traveled a bit, but have always lived in California. And I was looking at a map one day while I was right in the middle of all my research, or not in the middle, but I mean at the start of what we call field work, you know, at the school I went to. And I was thinking, what am I going to do and who am I going to study and all that? And I'm staring at this map, and it's a map of the first cities in California that stretch from San Diego to Sonoma, which is all along the western coast. And they had been colonized by the Spaniard Padres, who came here in the 1700s to convert the Indians and to give the Spanish Empire a foothold in California. And this, the where every one of the missions they had established had a little cross by it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this really looks very familiar, and not just because I'm a Californian, you know. And I realized with a shock that every city I had ever lived next to was a mission city, and that the path of colonization through California mirrored my path through California myself, you know, starting out in San Diego and then moving to the various mission towns, Los Angeles, Ventura, Santa Barbara. And the feeling I had when I realized that was, it seemed as though something had made me go that way, you know, that there was a force operating like an unconscious dynamic. And I thought, well, maybe there's some influence from the place going on. You know, maybe something in the environment needs a second look, mm-hmm. if only to satisfy myself that maybe this is just who knows what, you know. So that's where my research got started. And then along the way, more surprises. And I think the ones that stay with me the most are when contemporary people who live in a particular place unconsciously act out its historical conflicts. The methodology I created during my doctoral work is specifically designed to study how that happens, because it works very much like in psychology would be called an issue or a complex. And an example of that would be the American who built up, San Diego was named Alonzo Horton. And before he became a city builder, he vacationed a bit in Panama. And he wasn't terribly far from where the old Aztec Empire had been, although it was a little bit further north from where he was. But basically, he was in the New World, you know. And so he ended up being in this hotel that was attacked by a mob. You know, there was some kind of riot going on. And he rushed out of the hotel with a bunch of people that he was on the cruise ship with, and they all kind of banded together, and they ran up backwards on this gangplank to get back to their ship. And he was shooting his revolver in self-defense at the crowd that was pursuing him. And once he had got aboard the ship, he realized, oh, I've just lost $10,000 worth of gold dust I left behind in the hotel room, you know. Now, the odd thing about this incident, which looked at by itself doesn't mean much, you know, is that if you know your New World history, you'll recognize this as a reenactment of the initial Spaniard retreat from the Aztec capital city under fire up a gangplank and having left their gold behind. So there's all these uncanny parallels that go on in terms of past and present. And, of course, the weirdest thing is the name of the ship that Horton retreated to was called the Cortez. You see. So these sorts of things... which I studied at first primarily in California, and then I started looking for them all over the world, especially in capital cities like Rome and Paris. These sort of things are frequent. They're not oddities or rarities. They happen all the time. But we miss them because our culture, which splits the person from the place, the present from the past and all that, does not allow us really in its education for us to make these connections. You know, in other words, to see the parallel, you have to know your New World history and compare the themes of what happened at one time with those of another occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I made it my business to do, to link up these themes, because for me, trained as a psychotherapist, they worked an awful lot like an unresolved issue. You know, it was as though the Aztec conquest by Cortez had opened a source of trauma historically and ecologically that was never adequately addressed. And so because the place itself was traumatized, somebody like Horton came along and relive the trauma thematically without realizing it.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if true, has enormous implications for human health and sanity. It means that where we live has a profound influence on what we do, the way we think, how we feel, what happens to our relationships. And in fact, we could be repeating these, what I call eco-historical points of anguish all the time without really realizing it, which is debilitating and dangerous and harmful. So
how do you think we can heal through this? Like if we are so intricately connected to our sense of place, what ways do you see, like, we must have some power as well to perhaps heal or bring an end to destructive cycles, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. One of the first things I noticed when I really got into this was the number of historical situations in California that I was living out in my life. And each of the mission cities that I lived in quickly presented their eco-historical conflicts to me without my realizing it at the time I was living there. But looking back and having studied the history of those places, I could now, you know, line the themes up pretty nicely. What I noticed was that the more attentive I was to how this worked, the more I would listen to the place, the more the themes would show up in non-pathological ways, in ways that didn't force me to live them out. And there's a parallel to this in psychotherapy where clients who do real well in therapy will often say, now I can hear my injuries or my feelings in my heart without projecting them onto other people or acting them out blindly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something very similar works with place, which actually makes sense if you take the step of figuring that places have psychological qualities of some sort that exist in a field with our own. There are ecological theorists who actually say that place behaves like an unconscious. So it makes sense that getting to know a place, hearing its trauma, reading into its history, and looking at it psychologically, kind of like a client, would increase awareness of the issues of that place and also make a person feel closer to where they live. That's certainly been the case with me. If you can get past, and one of the things, there's a researcher in San Diego, Laura Mitchell. She's a doctoral student at the Pacifica Graduate Institute. And she's doing some work on this down there, and she likes to say that, as with clients in therapy, the key seems to be to break through the wall of anesthesia and numbing that keeps us from feeling the full weight of the conflict in these places. And she would say that the lack of emphasis on listening to the environment and caring about it is one of the outcomes of that kind of very widespread numbing that we have going on in our civilization. So that seems to be the first step, to learn the history of a place, to understand what's happened to its ecology, and to be willing to open one's heart to whatever themes of suffering have gone on in such a place.
And it's a feedback loop, too, because like our numbing is a symptom of the separation, but it also perpetuates the separation as well.
Yeah, that's a very important point. Yeah, I think that's, yeah. It reminds me, putting it that way, reminds me of something the analyst Karen Horney pointed out. She was the first psychoanalyst to emphasize those kinds of vicious feedback loops in terms of how they tend to make character disorders worse over time rather than better. So I think that's a very important point. I think that happens ecologically as well.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people, some eco-psychologists, you know, advocate like environmental activism, or even like just not like make the connections between like activism as a way of like healing not only the place but also our own psyches as well. Like, for example, pulling out invasive non-native species as a way of like also pulling out the colonized mind within us as well, so to say. And
yeah.
I think that's kind of neat. Different ways we can like take an active approach to healing both ourselves and the place we live in.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's important to find ways to do that that are literally grounded.
Yeah.
I haven't had a lot of experience myself with, for instance, political protest, mm-hmm. that kind of activism. But I make sure to do plenty of gardening because it gives me the sense of actually having my hands in the soil from which we all sprang, you know.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I would emphasize to environmentalists who are listening in is there seems to be a habit sometimes of keeping the action only literal, you know, chaining yourself to a drinking fountain to protest the bulldozers coming in, all of which is great. I mean, those things need to go on. But I think it's inherent in learning to listen to a place that, however it presents itself to you, you react to as a deepening beyond just whatever activity you're taking, you know. A parallel would be having a client who's a domestic violence victim, and I've worked with quite a few of those, by the way, and listening to her talk about the abusive men in her life. And you know, the emotional reaction of the counselor oftentimes is to say, oh, I got to give her skills that'll help her not be around such men. I got to tell her who can advocate for her, put her in touch with the police, and that kind of thing, all of which needs to be done. But there also, at the same time, needs to be a psychological deepening into what's going on that she's in this situation, you know. And not only is in it now, I mean, anyone can be a victim any time, but this seems to be a pattern in her life, a destructive one, and there has to be some kind of exploration of that at a deeper level. And so in the same way, I think it helps environmental activism, especially when it's very localized, to kind of spend some time wondering what would help the place, you know. Will it help me to be a member of a human chain that blocks the construction of some big project that's going to eat a big portion of the city? Maybe it will. Maybe that's the appropriate response. But notice the non-human move here. What does the place want, you know? Does the place have any say?
I think that's a great point. It's a very good point. It comes back to listening as well and recognizing that there is a spirit of place that does have its own inherent, you know, subjectivity, I guess. And I think that's a great point. Derek Jensen talks a lot about that, actually. You know, before you do an action, listen and ask.
Yeah.
Ask what the river or what the forest actually wants. And that's a little bit tough for some people to even comprehend, you know, like, because we so often regard non-human life as inanimate and objectify non-human life to such a degree. But I guess it comes back to that ability to listen as well.
Yes. Often when people hear this sort of stuff, they immediately go into, well, you're projecting your humanness onto the landscape, you know, and that's why it seems alive to you. And what I've said in the past by way of response is, first of all, that's a misuse of the concept of projection. A projection is about getting rid of your shadow material, as Jung would call it, you know, getting rid of intolerable inner states. And it's when it's used in terms of a critique of people who want to listen to the landscape, all that's kind of thrown out, and projection is wielded like just you're projecting, you know, like it's just this general thing that goes on all the time with no trauma and no analysis, and, you know. So that's the first thing. The second is when people say things like places do not have reactions like this because they don't have a nervous system or a brain, the assumption there is that our nervous systems and our brains are somehow separate from the place. But if you don't buy that, then, well, the place has ours, you know, and those of other creatures that live on it. And in psychology in particular, there's been a shift in talking about what clients project into the therapist and what the therapist projects into the client. It's very push-pull, cause-effect stuff. All that's pretty much given way now, especially in the analytic community, to talking about interactive fields, where there's just this kind of thing in the air. No one really knows what it is, a psychological field of some kind. And everyone present makes their own contribution to it, but nobody knows how much. There's no way to measure whose is what. And the important thing is to work what's going on between people rather than putting so much emphasis on what's going on within people, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so similarly, when we listen to places, it's helpful to bear that in mind and to get away from some of those mind-body-splitting questions of how much of it is me, how much of it is the place, am I crazy, you know, I think places talk to me, I ought to be locked up, that kind of stuff, you know. And to think, well, there's a field here of some kind. I can feel it operating. The themes that happen in this place parallel the themes in my life. Why not just listen in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and when you do, all kinds of things happen. The place finds ways of showing up again, giving hints and dreams. All kinds of things happened.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I want to read another quote of yours, actually, just to spur a bit more conversation. And because I want to kind of talk a bit about like wildness and wilderness and how that contrasts everything that all the illusions of control in our society. And you wrote that we hate the world because we fear it. And we fear it because it's not only mysterious and vast and ultimately unknowable, but animated by the one quality our civilization cannot tolerate, either inwardly or outwardly, and that is wildness, an all-encompassing unpredictability reaching beyond human control. And I really like that because so many people in our society are afraid of anything that is wild, and we see it in the perfectly manicured lawns and in the proliferation of fences and locks and all that symbology of control. And I wonder how that relates to your research, especially in the field of terror psychology or in general in your research, basically how that relates to like the wilderness within ourselves and how that's becoming domesticated and how we can overcome that.
Yeah, that's a very good question and a very important one, especially these days when so much is being domesticated in the, both the human and the non-human realms.
Mm-hmm.
I've been saying recently in presentations and interviews that we can no longer separate what goes on in, with the environment with what goes on culturally and politically for that very reason. The mindset of domination and taming and control is so uncritically destructive because it's unreflective that it treats those we like to call minorities, especially people of color, pretty much the same way it treats the earth. You know, in fact, that's been a standard racist criticism of blacks, Mexicans, you know, everyone who's a shade more, quote, color than white people are, you know, that they're closer to nature, they're beasts, they're animals, and so forth. And so there's this very old Western tradition of domination of the natural world, domination of the feminine, and domination of people of color all fitting together, all being lumped into the same kind of category of, you're less than human, you're closer to the world that's fallen, to use the Christian term. So for that reason alone, we have to look at why that is and what it is that we fear. The poet Linda Hogan is... I think it was in an interview actually with Derek Jensen. She said that the fear of loss and control, the fear of wild places, and the fear of indigenous people are all the same fear. And I think that gets right to the heart of what the problem is. So in the terror psychology piece that is going to appear in an anthology on something called ecotherapy, which is the practical application of eco-psychology, ecotherapy, healing ourselves with nature-based methods. The point in the terror psychology piece was that the agenda of control is basically driven by fear and hatred. We fear the natural world and we hate it. And that's something that's, thousands of years old. You know, it may have started 10,000 years ago. But whatever the origins of it, it's evident to at least to a clinical eye. If the clinical eye turns to matters environmental, that the way especially government officials, and I'm thinking here, of course, of the Bush administration, treat the environment cannot simply be dismissed as ignorance or, well, they just don't have their facts straight, or, you know, it's political to dismiss things like global warming studies as junk science, you know. It's not reducible to that any more than when you're talking to a perpetrator of violence. And that I'm speaking from 6 years of working with such men. And they say, well, I just popped my girlfriend because I just had a bad day, or I didn't mean anything by it. And what you quickly realize is there's a great deal of hatred involved that never gets acknowledged. It's not talked about in the press. Nobody's standing up and saying, you know, this is an agenda of hatred. You hate the earth, and you need to face up to it, you know. It's an extremely, well, you can see all around, you know, if you just read the environmental news, it's an extremely destructive syndrome. But it's even more powerful by virtue of the fact that it's unspoken, even by environmentally inclined people. You know, there's a funny lack of not really understanding the opposition among people that call themselves progressives for some reason. Maybe it's just because they don't hate the earth and they can't have a hard time understanding this mentality, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I probably would have if I hadn't worked with a lot of perpetrators. But when you really listen in on them and what their fears are, you kind of get it, you know. So I think that a first step for environmentally conscious people who want to make a difference is, before taking any action, realizing the depth of hatred that motivates a lot of this destruction of the ecosphere.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people have a tough time viewing it as hatred, I think. A lot of people who are more like, I don't know exactly what, more pacifist, not necessarily pacifist, that's probably the wrong way to say it, but a lot of people, I find a lot of more passive people or environmentalists have a tough time looking at it as hatred, and I think would rather see it as ignorance.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot more difficult to deal with hatred, and it's a lot more difficult to deal with people in power when you know that they actually know what they're doing, and it's a conscious thing. It's easier to look at it as ignorance and think about it. If we just give them enough facts, then they'll change the way they're doing. When in reality, they know all the facts, and they're still doing it. That necessarily implies a shift in tactics and priorities, I think.
Yeah, absolutely it does. I read something a while back that really kind of amazed me. I think it was written by a couple of therapists to President Bush, and I hope it was a joke. So if whoever's listening wrote that, I fell for it. You know, and I'm glad that it's a joke because I don't want to believe that it's real. What it basically did was kind of this letter tried to enlighten the president about the various aspects of the environmental problem. And maybe if he could just be more reflective and get to know himself a little bit better. There was a bit of pop psychology in there, too, you know, just work on yourself and journal a bit and stuff. And when I look at things like that, the first word that comes to my mind is denial, you know. And it was very similar to when I would sometimes talk to other therapists about the dynamics of what goes on with perpetrators, domestic violence perpetrators, and then other kinds. I worked with quite a wide variety of violent men and some violent women. And the therapist would actually kind of echo some of the responses of the victims who didn't really want to believe that it could be that bad. And so I would hear a lot of talk about, well, if they just worked on themselves or if they just realized how wounded they were and so on and so forth. And if they, the common one was if they would just be more conscious. And I would think, you know, it takes a lot of consciousness to stalk somebody and not get caught, you know. It takes a lot of consciousness to, as one man did, to kind of follow your partner around through an office building by telephoning her colleagues to see where she was, you know. Consciousness of that sort isn't the problem. You know, consciousness of the wounding below that, of course, is a different issue. But there seems to be this almost universal unwillingness to really look at the depth of pathology that's involved in people that make destructive decisions, whether it's the environment or decisions that impact, you know, the poor in this country, in the USA, the third world, whatever it is. And it always reminds me of something Rollo May said, that the ultimate mistake is the refusal to look evil in the face. And I would say that the same thing is true of human destructiveness as it manifests in terricide and other forms of, I don't even know what you would call it, the unwillingness to even grant any kind of intrinsic value to things outside yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would say about that is I've recently been thinking that paranoia has been vastly underestimated as a force in politics. And you do hear about paranoia, and people are often, the president or whoever, you know, they're paranoid, and, you know, liberals are paranoid or conservatives are paranoid or whatnot. But it's always discussed as kind of a separate quality or dynamic in human behavior, along with greed and narcissism and things like that, you know. The impression I'm getting, and borrowing from my work with the captive populations that came to see me after being incarcerated, when you compare their tactics with the way some governments operate, you know, keeping citizens in a permanent state of fear, which is a batterer technique, you get the idea that paranoia is far more entrenched in such people than we really give them credit for. And I think it's a key part of terroricidal behavior as well. I think that the fear of the world is intrinsic to both, to both ecological destruction and paranoid behavior at high levels. And in terms, if you look at a diagnostic list for paranoid behaviors, one of the first ones that comes up is a profound distrust of the world. It's usually not meant eco-psychologically, but that's what it comes down to, I think.
Yeah.
So I think to understand why people behave terroricidally, it's also necessary to understand paranoia.
Very interesting stuff. Where do you think that this split came from? Like, a lot of people, look at Greek philosophers and how deeply they entrench the views of, what is to be strived for is to be above human, and then there's people who take it as far back as like symbolic thought or domestication of plants. But where do you see, like, because in so many indigenous cultures that have existed before like contact with industrial civilization or colonizers, they didn't have the same kind of rampant social illnesses as we do now. Where do you see this split having arisen from?
Yeah, it's it sure goes far back too. You know, one can only speculate because it goes back to prehistory. The consensus in the eco-psychological community is that when we started building fences that walled ourselves off from nature, which goes with monocropping and agriculture and what history books call the agricultural revolution, it removed us from direct contact with the natural world by very slow degrees. Chelis Glendinning talks a lot about that in her books, especially My Name is Chelis, that one.
Yeah.
And so because we're wired, basically, by evolution to live as part of the natural world, there is what Chelis calls an original wounding that goes on, and so people start becoming more and more destructive over time. And then, of course, the whole ball of centralized power gets rolling. You know, you need to make sure the crops are okay. You need priests to, you know, placate the gods, and then you need accountants to keep track of it all, and then chieftains who are heads of armies to guard it from being stolen by other sedentary cultures, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that what's missing from all that discussion is precisely this point of paranoia, because what seems to happen is, and you see this in small groups and even today in the corporate environment, it's intrinsic to the paranoid mentality not only to fear and distrust the world, but to want to control it for that very reason. Paranoid people don't do well in messy or novel situations. They always have to have their hand in them. They're very fussy and always afraid that something unexpected is going to kind of jump on them out of nowhere. So they want to control everything, or as much as they can. And so what I got to thinking was, what would happen if you had say a village, an agricultural village, that had probably, a very small minority of people with a paranoid personality. You know, who knows where it ultimately comes from. But let's say there's, you know, out of 100 people, there's maybe 2 or 3 who have paranoid tendencies, who are afraid of life, afraid of the world, and another important point about it is they don't feel they belong in the world at a very deep level. I suspect that that's why some of them are such vociferous anti-abortion protesters, because they feel aborted from the creation, you know. So these are the kinds of people that love power because it gives them control, whereas healthier people don't particularly like power. It involves a huge amount of responsibility. It's a complete pain. You know, you got to regulate this and run that, and, you know. So it's hard to get responsible people into positions of authority, because they resist it. They don't want that kind of accountability, you know. they have enough trouble running their own lives. And so the people that step forward to be accountants and priests and chieftains are the paranoid people who go, I'll do it. I love this kind of work, you know. So they assume positions of command and control, and because they're threatened by more spontaneous personalities and people that do unexpected things, and especially people who feel joy about living in the world, who feel like they really belong, well, that's intolerable. So the paranoid people, and this is such a corporate exercise too, you know. I worked in the corporate world for 14 years, and I saw this all the time. They start getting rid of healthier personalities, and they start promoting the ones who think like they do, you know. So my thought about it is that if you do that for 10,000 years, you have a big chunk of Western civilization, destructive to the earth, constantly involved in warfare. In the U.S., you know, there's a huge religious fundamentalism movement going on that's been working quietly for a long time and now breaking out in the open. All kinds of paranoid thinking there, you know. And so it seems to me that a combination of our original separation from the natural world, brought about by monocrop agriculture, where only one variety of something is cultivated, similar to an ideology, you know, combines with an inability to keep paranoid people out of high office. And so the results are the Age of Empires, you know, Sargon the First conquering Sumer and, you know, unceasing warfare ever since. So my guess would be that's where it comes from, but no one really knows.
It's a pretty good explanation, I'd say. Dan, I really want to keep talking with you, but I think I should get going.
Okay.
There's a chance I might get a phone call at 3, so that's in 5 minutes.
Okay.
But thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I feel we could talk for another hour easily.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too.
Yeah.
Quick question. Is there any way I can tell people about my website, or is
please
that
do,
not
please
allowed?
Do. No, it's definitely encouraged.
Okay.
Yeah.
If people want to read a little bit more about the upcoming book and some of the other, there's some papers on these topics. If you surf to, I'll say it and then I'll spell it. It's tearsofyorona.com, and that's spelled TEARSOFLLORONA.com. You can find out some more things about this. And if you didn't get that, just call a radio station and they'll have it.
I'll say it again later on as well.
Great.
But yeah. So thanks kindly, Craig, for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Nice. Thanks a lot for talking. And this interview, I recorded it, and it'll be available online soon. I'll let you know about that.
Great. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Craig. See you later. Okay. Bye.